I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I first encountered the Exploring Vancouver books in elementary school. They were uniquely shaped books, and I'd sign them out of the library at Charles Dickens Elementary often to look at the black and white images of Vancouver buildings. A few years ago, when I was old enough to buy my own copies, I couldn't remember the title or the author, so I emailed the late Chuck Davis, and minutes later, he fired off a response with the author's name and title, as well as a listing of how many subsequent editions there were. First published in 1974, the books are guides to the city's architecture, as well as something one could walk to, discovering history and many buildings in Vancouver. Subsequent editions were released in 1978 and 1993. They've gone on to chronicle how the city looks, as well trends in architecture, development, land use, and heritage preservation. Now, a new edition is out, written by Harold Kalman and Robin Ward, with photographs by John Rofe. Mr. Kalman joins me to talk about this new edition, how the book came about nearly 40 years ago, and what we glean from our architecture about who we are, what Vancouver is, and where it's headed. Harold D. Kalman earned a Ph.D. in the history of art and architecture from Princeton University. He has written many books, including A History of Canadian Architecture, Pioneer Churches, and Exploring Ottawa. He taught architectural history at the University of British Columbia and now teaches heritage conservation at the universities of Hong Kong and Victoria. His website is at haroldkalman.ca. Exploring Vancouver, the architectural guide, is published by Douglas and McIntyre. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Hal Kalman. Mr. Kalman, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us. So when we look at our architecture, what do we learn about our city?
Architecture tells us all kinds of stories. And I like to think of architecture as a conveyor of stories as opposed to simply a built art form, which it is, among other things. We, first and foremost, I guess we see four walls and a roof, or however many it is, depending on the shape. We see a form, and we see a very solid form, and we know that people use this place. So I guess our first questions that we ask ourselves, and the answers to what you want, is what is this place? Why is it used? Who uses it? What is it for? Then we probably want to look at it a little bit more beyond just accommodation, at what does it look like? And that brings in questions of art, and I sort of shy away from the word style, but I'll use the word style, and form, and sensitivities of the person who designed it and the client who wanted it. But then, beyond all that, there are the, and I use the very simple word stories, the stories of the people who have been there, the people who have used it, the people who have designed it, the people who have commented on it. And all this put together tells us really about the nature of where we are in our place. It's not only the history of our place, it's also, as you said very aptly, the future of our place. What's the development history of Vancouver? Where does this fit into the larger development of the city? Why did it happen? When it happened? And, I mean, this all sounds very theoretical, but a lot of it really is quite interesting and sort of goes on and can keep us. And I think I call this the art of reading buildings. Mm-hmm. And what we want to do is learn not only to see them, but to read them. I think our book gives a few clues as to how to do that. But people pick it up and they learn how to do it and they don't really need prompting. They may not have all the information that lets them know, and so they need something like our book or something else to get that information. But I think if we can get people to look above the front door and the shop windows at what's happening above and around it, people will enjoy the city very much more.
And from just, say you pick up the book and you sort of glance through, you leaf through it, you get a sense that this is a very young city, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's all in relative terms, of course. It's young now. I guess the city was incorporated in 1886. The first Europeans were here in the middle of the 19th century. First Nations have been here for many thousands of years before then. So there have been a lot of layers of occupation and such. But if we think of us in our sort of Western European and Asian eyes, as the beginning of a place to when permanent buildings were built, which is really only a very small blip on the scale, then yeah, we're just about 125 or 150 years old.
Yeah. Did you find people that in the city that they're savvy about about how we should look at architecture, say, or how we should look at our buildings?
I think a lot of them are, but I think we're aiming here at both a, I think mainly a general audience, just people who are interested in the place. We're also intending the book to be read more by architects and specialists who see things in a different way. But no, I think the general public are much more savvy about social and political history and stories than they are about architecture. They can see things and they can think themselves, I like it or I don't like it, but don't always go very much beyond that. And we're trying to help them ease into a deeper understanding of what they're seeing.
So the original book came out, I guess, 38 years ago. How did that come about?
I was then a... I was younger, I promise. I was then a young teacher at UBC, and I taught my favorite course was a course in North American architecture, architectural history. And I had some very, very keen students the first couple of years, and we did field work in town, and we documented and recorded places. The department was then actually commissioned by the city to do the first inventory of buildings in Gastown and Chinatown. But what happened through all this is I had a chance to see how the students learned to read buildings. And I've always been very interested in the historic environment and the present environment, but in the built place around me. And I'm not quite sure how Gastown and Chinatown morphed into the larger city, but that was kind of the sequence of things. You mentioned Chuck Davis. Chuck was a part of it. He and I were quite close back then.
Yeah.
And we were, he was on radio. He used to be the afternoon guy on CBC.
Right.
And Chuck and I were going to do a series of radio shows on buildings. It never quite happened. But partly out of that, I got the idea, let's just actually do a book. And John Rofe lived in Vancouver then. He moved on to much bigger pastures and became an architectural photographer in England, where he still lives.
Mm-hmm.
But John and I knew each other, and we said, hey, why not? Let's just go for it. And so I had a year's sabbatical, I guess. Yeah, it was done partly while I was teaching and then finished during sabbatical. And it became a labor of love. It's an awful lot of work to do all this, but there were a lot of records out there, and I was just curious enough to read them. The city had terrific files, which nobody appreciated. They're now in the city archives, but there was no city archives in those days. And it was just all, a little voyage of discovery for me, and really a labor of love to put it down.
And did you think at the time that it would last 40 years, say?
Oh, no way. I mean, I didn't know whether I was going to last 40 years. No, I mean, I thought of it as a one-time thing. And the original publisher was University of BC Press.
Mm-hmm.
And the odd shape, which indeed it was
yeah,
sort of to make you think Michelin guidebook.
Yeah.
But it turned out the odd shape meant it didn't sell so well because it didn't fit into book racks. And so we're much more practical now. We do things that fit into standard racks.
Yeah.
But, no, I never thought about whether it would have an afterlife or not. It was just something for the here and now. And I know that cities change quickly. I had no idea Vancouver was going to change as quickly as it has, but that it would soon become obsolescent. And then I guess UBC asked for a second edition, as you mentioned, just a couple of years, about 4 years later.
Yeah.
And that was really just a tune-up. That wasn't a lot of work. It was a matter of just going all the tours, and a friend of mine did a lot of the work, and I did some of it, and a few others did as well, and just removing what had been lost and adding the more important things that had been built and so on. So that was easy. And then it went long. It was just long out of print.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in the early 1990s, the third edition had three authors, myself, Robin Ward, and we're the authors of the fourth edition,
mm-hmm,
but also Ron Phillips, who lived in Vancouver then. And it was Ron's initiative. He knew Robin, and he knew me, and he said, why don't we do this? And I think I was skeptical, but then we all got caught on by Ron's enthusiasm. And that particular book happened. And Robin was the photographer for the third edition. UBC Press did it again, but it was very different in format and very much more terse. And I think Robin and I, in retrospect, say, you know, we tried too hard to fit the book, every entry into 63 words or whatever it was, and that didn't do any of the entries justice. And so in the present one, which again was Ron Phillips' idea, and he was originally a co-author, but he lives in Ontario, and it was a little hard for me. He decided to withdraw, but did some initial research. But anyways, again, it was Ron's enthusiasm, and we all decided that let this be a bit more form, and if a book wants to go on for a page, let it. If it only wants a paragraph, let it happen. If an entry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it was, and then we're just utterly delighted that Peter Cocking and his colleagues, the designers at Douglas and McIntyre, sort of took this idea and, in my estimation, made a, I'm not supposed to say this, but I'm bragging about Douglas and McIntyre, the publisher, not about ourselves,
mm-hmm.
made a really beautiful product of it, where the way in which one entry flows into another and the way in which things are as long, only as long as they have to be, I think really works.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. How did you, you and Ward, how did you write the pieces? I mean, did
Robin, I should tell you also that Robin is well known to Vancouverites because he lived here for quite a while.
Right.
And was the architectural critic for the Vancouver Sun and wrote a number of other books. I'm the only one of the three who actually lives in Vancouver, and I'm the only and I'm not even born here, but I've lived here most of the last 40-odd years, I guess. But at any rate, Robin's a Scot, though anybody who's met him knows that without asking any questions, and he lives in Edinburgh. He came over several times. He was here all of the summer of 2010, but made some other trips. He wrote half the entries. He wrote half the tours. There are 14 chapters. We call them tours. The publisher likes to call them chapters.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote seven. I wrote seven. But then we simply exchanged, and he worked on every one of mine, and I worked on every one of his. So we wanted to make it sound like a single voice, and we don't even tell people which we started, I started, which he started. But the collaboration was very well. We could not have done this in the days before the internet and email.
Right.
Because Robin did what research he could by the internet, but then I and some research assistants at this end followed up with phone calls and things that want to happen locally.
And do you come to the same conclusions about, say, a building?
Well, we don't really come to any conclusions at all. That sounds facetious, but we point things out, and in some cases they're contradictory, and we let the reader do it. But the more direct answer to your question, Joe, no, we look at buildings somewhat differently and very complementarily, and that's why I think this works. Robin is a designer by upbringing. He was trained at the Glasgow School of Art, Charles Rennie Mackintosh and all that. And Robin is a designer and an architectural critic, and he sees architecture much more for form, style, and materials. I'm educated as an architectural historian with the emphasis on the historian part, and I see them much more for the people. And so in the first draft, mine were much more social and Robin's were much more architectural and stylistically critical and descriptive. And then that's why by each of us modifying the other ones, we came to that happy medium that's both. But it wasn't the case of conclusion. I like Robin's approach and his descriptions, and I think he's right on. I can't write them because I don't have that critical visual vocabulary nearly easily as he does. And likewise, he was very happy with the... He had a lot of anecdotal stuff, too. Mine was maybe more based in longer research, and I helped him with some of his in the same sort of way. And I guess we let the reader judge, but I think it worked.
Now, the photographs, Rolf did the photographs for the first two editions, I guess, and,
yeah.
And then now he's done the ones for this. How do you, because we have Google now, and we have, Google Maps and the sort, and we can see these buildings if we wanted to, but there is something different that he does, and I'm trying to figure out what that is.
Well, again, just like we want the text to read as a single voice, we want the photographs to read as a single voice. In this case, an artistic voice. All the photographs are new. They're all in color now. They were all in black and white before.
Yeah.
But every single one is new. I have always thought the world of John as an architectural photographer, because John, to me, more than almost any other photographer going, is not... He manages to produce a portrait of a building in a single image, which gives you an idea of the building, its form, its function, its shape, and its context. There's always something other than the building surrounding it, and you really understand its context. And that may sound easy, because John hides his art, so to speak. It just looks like a straightforward picture, but
yeah.
It's not all that easy. And I think he's a total genius at it. there aren't a lot of art. If you look through other architecture books and pictures, most of them have a more, what I call, expressionistic point of view. Details, visuals that are stunning just as visuals, but John's give information as well as being stunning, straightforward portraits.
And how do you decide what is in the book? Like, I mean, I'm sure there are buildings that aren't in here that...
Arguing and debating and all this. We had an idea of an appropriate length. When we talked to Douglas and McIntyre, we knew it wanted to be sort of 400-odd entries, mm-hmm. and not 600, not 200. So that helped us. We had real criteria. The criteria was either that, whether it be for architectural reasons or for social political reasons or for development of Vancouver reasons, it had to either be quite exceptional, not just very exceptional, but quite exceptional, or very representative. Now, those are the two poles. Exceptional tends towards the unique, and representative tends towards the general and the ordinary. And so, if, for example, Vancouver specials were very characteristic of Vancouver, it's utterly essential to have Vancouver specials in the book, mm-hmm. because that was what Vancouver residential development was all about in the 1970s. And so we have one big cluster of Vancouver specials on Ross Street, not far from 49th. And we have others that appear here and there, and we have the new Vancouver special, which was an attempt to go one better. But that would qualify as representative. So would some of the office buildings from the 1912 pre-World War I era, where a lot of stuff went up that looked the same, and so too are the office buildings from the Concord Pacific era, which very much looked the same, but we had to have something that represented that. And at the other end, you have the extraordinary gestures. The cover, for example, shows the Woodward's development.
Right.
And Woodward's is extraordinary. People can love it or they can hate it, and there are articulate voices on both sides of that spectrum, and I'm not going to take one or the other, but it's now a very emphatic part of the Vancouver landscape. It tells an awful lot about the attempts to revitalize the downtown east. Well, the story starts with the number one retailer in all of British Columbia, Woodward's, and it morphs from being a retail story into being a housing story, into being an urban revitalization story. And you really kind of understand then that part of Hastings Street went from being Vancouver's number one retail street, and then it started sliding off the map, and there's an attempt to put it right back on the map again. And so that's what I mean by development history. And again, the building is quite extraordinary, the tower, and again, you may love it or not love it, it doesn't matter, it wants to be there. And those are the criteria we had. And of course, you know, any two people are going to disagree. This one should be in, this one should be out. But I would say that 80 or 90% of the things Robert and I and John agreed 100% on. And then the ones around the edges really don't matter very much. And we have secondary entries. Like a particular entry will illustrate and describe and give the details and the stories of one place. But often towards the end of the description, in boldface, you have a few other things in the neighborhood that you can look at, but which aren't illustrated and which we don't go into in more detail. And they're the fringe ones. They maybe should be in, but they're not quite as important to the book.
And in terms of the research that you did you get to go to all inside of all of the buildings?
No. And we very much respect the privacy of private buildings. Everyone, of course, was visited externally.
Yeah.
If it's available to the public, we went in. In some cases, if they're not available to the public, we went in anyways. But we would never encourage readers to. And we stress this in the introduction too, that readers and users of the book, there are maps that get people around, should respect privacy and not try to poke around and sneak around. And that gave us a real problem with particularly the early modern houses in West Vancouver, because a lot of them were far from the street, and the landscapes have matured, and you can't see them. And if we omitted some real gems, real architectural gems, because they're no longer visible from the public roadway,
mm-hmm.
and we had a problem there, because we figured if we put it in, we would be inviting people to trespass, and we didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So in some cases, again, we mentioned them as secondary entries. We have one or two One was an early Arthur Erickson house we simply could not leave out. But we make it very clear there's a caveat that says don't go see it.
What about the backs of the buildings? I mean, are they as interesting as the front?
Say? Oh, yeah, they are. But the again, our self-proclaimed rule was there shall be one image only per development.
Yeah.
Now, there are a few of them, the one image is an interior, and there are a few of them, Joe, where the one image is not the front. But that was John's judgment, how he thought he could capture the essence of the place in a single shot. Now, he took multiples, and he and we went through them and chose what we thought was the one that was either the best image or coincided best with the text, or we would adjust the text to go with the picture. So there was a lot of little detail to-ing and fro-ing over that to try to make the whole thing hold together.
How are we doing in terms of heritage preservation, and how should it work? I mean, does everything have to be saved?
Well, absolutely not, no. And the book tries to make the point. The book is about old, I'm going to get to your question in a second. It's about old buildings, it's about new buildings, and it particularly dwells on buildings that have been changed and well changed, and like Woodward's being one of them, over the years. In my way of looking at it, and I have been a conservation consultant in the heritage business as a professional for years, the best cities combine the best of the old with the best of the new. And so we have to determine what the best of the old is. And again, I would say that's either both the extraordinary and the representative. But it's not the mediocre somewhere in the middle. But also, buildings don't want to be isolated. They're parts of neighborhoods, and so in some cases, neighborhoods are important. And we want to find a way where we can always have change and development and new things going on, but in a way that doesn't, in an ideal world, challenge the integrity of the things that should happen for the future. And we measure integrity in terms of what are those characteristics, those elements, those components that give the building its heritage character. And we try very hard to work with those. But in the case like that the interior isn't, or if the back isn't, then additions and interior renovations are fair game, as long as it doesn't hurt the heritage character of the place. Now, that is a less extreme point of view. There are other points of view, and you have it in UK, for example, where there's much more emphasis on slowing the pace of change to old buildings. But we live in a very development-intensive, we're pragmatic, we have a very development-intensive place that we live in, Vancouver, with enormously high real estate values, with a political mood, or I guess a political stance, that doesn't quite say that a person's home is his or her castle, but comes pretty close to it. And it talks about these things called property rights, which I might challenge in another forum. I think we only have the rights that are given to us by the state at any given time. But aside from that, we have a very development-friendly political climate, and therefore, to be pragmatic, one has to work within both. How could we do a decent job of conservation and a decent job of development? And this city has developed a very, very progressive conservation program. It started in the 1980s. It was born in the 1970s, probably with the loss of the Burks Building. It always takes, old-timers will remember the Burks Building at Granville in Georgia. It always takes one disaster to awaken a city. In New York, it was the loss of Pennsylvania Station in the 1960s, for example. And the city developed a program that encourages change, that doesn't penalize property owners for owning old buildings. And so if you own an old building and the building is worth keeping, but you can't make a proper dollar, a proper return on your investment as a private investor on it, the city will give you back something in return. It won't give you money, except in Gastown and Chinatown, it'll give you a little bit of money. It won't give you money, it'll give you either more development rights or bonusing or something. It may, in the case of the Stanley Theater, for example, they did two wonderful things. One of them was to waive the need for parking. Mm-hmm. The Arts Club Theater simply pointed out that there are a million parking spaces within two blocks there because that's a rather intensive office area and store area, and the spaces are all open, are all vacant on nights and Sundays for the most part, and therefore they could be double used and used by the Stanley. And so Stanley didn't have to build parking. saved an enormous amount of money. And we did what we call the transfer of density rights, where the property of the Stanley could have been developed more intensively than what is there. You could go up much higher. And so the unrealized density, that part of the right to develop that has not been developed, gets sold to somebody else who then develops his or her building higher or bulkier. And some of the density from the Stanley went to the tall tower at the Wall Center. And the first case of that, of course, was Christchurch Cathedral in the early 70s, where Park Place, just down Burrard Street from the cathedral, is much bulkier and higher than was allowed during the time. And in return for that, the Christchurch Cathedral is there for generations to enjoy and use. Park Place's developers make money, and Park Place pays every year to the cathedral, to the diocese, a sum in six digits. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a win-win situation.
Now, you mentioned that the city has changed a great deal over the last 40 years or so since the first edition of the book. Do you have a sense of where it'll be in the next 40?
Nope. I wouldn't dare guess. And when we look around us, you know, is the world in recession? Is the world, is what's happening over in Europe and to a lesser extent in the U.S. going to spread much more into Canada? Are we going to go dull? Is the sustainability climate going to make us all develop less and reuse more? I mean, that's one scenario. And the other scenario is business as usual and the place will continue to develop. So, no, I don't have a guess, and I won't be here to see it two generations from now, so I can't even answer that question in the future. But we don't know, and maybe that's kind of a fun and excitement. We had no idea that the boom of the 1990s would happen. When we wrote the third edition of Exploring Vancouver in the early 90s, we had no idea that 15 years later the city would be part of the unrecognizable.
And are there things that we're doing wrong, say, that we shouldn't?
We're not, as far as I can see, we're not making any terribly disastrous mistakes. I mean, there are the little stupid things, if I can call them that, like the dilemma over transit, where everybody says we should do it, but every attempt the transit system gets to get some money from the source of that gets stymied. And that, to me, is just a silly thing that has to get resolved. But, you know, whether or not we have better transit is going to affect the future of our city. It's more than just how much carbon dioxide gets put into the atmosphere. It's much bigger than that. I think generally, Vancouver has taken on to densify. There is a regional growth plan which talks about what density should be in the future. And that's why you see Vancouver's densification, why something that's only a single-family house is taken down in a triplex or a fourplex put up in its place. And that's why everything's getting bigger and bulkier, because the city of Vancouver can't expand anywhere. It's sort of grown to its limits, and it's taken on to take more people, and in this competitive world, growth is thought of as a good thing. Now, the sustainability ethos makes us stop thinking growth is a good thing. Maybe things will happen very differently, but again, who knows?
And in the course of writing this new book, the fourth edition of Exploring Vancouver, did you ever think that perhaps you were capturing this time and this place?
We tried to very much. We talk a lot about the phenomenon called Vancouverism, mm-hmm. which is an approach to planning developed in this city. It's not the product of one person, but let's say it's associated with former planner Larry Beasley. Larry was a key player when that happened, but it was much bigger than him. It was the city's development and the developer's development, whereby we managed to get some very, very high densities in a way that doesn't show very much, or shows less than it did in other places. And you see this particularly on Pacific Boulevard in the Falls Creek area, in the Concord Pacific development, where properties are generally developed to most of the building lot, if not all the building lot, with a low podium, and then a tower set back from the street rises from the podium. But along the street, you're conscious of a three-story street wall and continual development. It very much feels like a city. And the actual number of units, the number of people that are being squeezed in per acre is quite remarkable. I don't know whether remarkably good or remarkably bad. I'll just sort of leave it at remarkable.
Well, what's next for you? Will you write other books like this?
Oh yeah. I actually closed my consulting practice 2 years ago, and I decided it was time to go back to doing what else I like to do, and one is writing. In the same genre, I'm actually working on a new edition of a book called Exploring Ottawa, which is the very same thing for Ottawa, where I lived for a number of years. And that is progressing with two colleagues who are from Ottawa. I'm also writing a rather large book for a more professional audience on heritage planning and heritage conservation. And I've got a whole bunch of little things in the fire, and as you mentioned, I teach. So I'm keeping busy between teaching and writing, but I like teaching, whether it's through books or through talking to students. And I kind of feel that we all want to leave this world a somewhat better and more educated place than it was, and we hope that we can contribute to it somehow, and that's my little contribution.
And I think you have with these books helped great deal. In the first edition of the book, one of my favorite parts of the book is at the end. You have a section of book buildings that were no longer, I guess, standing when the books came out. We don't have that section in this current edition. Would you consider doing something like that, say, in the future?
Not really, because no, and for ideological reasons. The heritage business is often a negatively cast. The Heritage Canada, our national lobby group, always talks about the 10 most endangered buildings in Canada. Heritage Vancouver, which is our local advocacy group, talks about the most endangered in Canada, the most endangered in Vancouver. And it's always tearing hair and tearing clothes and saying, oh, woe is us, they want to tear down all these things that are precious to us. And I don't like that. I think having the section, which we called In Memoriam, emphasized that. Look at the stuff we've lost. Aren't we badly off? And I'm much more of an optimist. I think that I don't see heritage conservation and development as being opponents at all. I see them as being partners. And again, I'll mention Woodward's as a case in point, not the case point. But there are dozens of examples in the book of partnerships where new development has very happily and positively done good things with old buildings. Think of the Wasc Center, for example, Simon Fraser University, which is and also part of a hotel. You know, I could talk about, think of Tudor Manor. And again, each of them opens up a dialogue as to whether it was done well or badly, and that's a very healthy dialogue. And we're not trying to bias people and make them see that they're all good, because some are better than others. But I see the two as partners, and I think to emphasize those that have fallen by the wayside is the wrong emphasis. And I think it's very important that we keep the balance, and we keep the balance between the new, the old, and the modified.
Hal, it's been such a pleasure talking today. We could talk all day. I appreciate your time, and this book is just a wonderful book. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you, Joe. I'm delighted you like it.
The website for more, haroldkelman.ca, written with Robin Ward, the photographs by John Rofe. Exploring Vancouver, the Architectural Guide. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. It's author Hal Kelman on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.